And this is NewsWorks Tonight. President Donald Trump campaigned on lifting the United States from the depths of the opioid epidemic. Amid criticism that his administration isn't acting fast enough on that promise, WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that cabinet members made a stop in Delaware County to say they're working on it.
Health Secretary Tom Price and White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway visited Miremont Treatment Center in Media for a closed-door meeting with law enforcement and treatment providers. They emerged with the stories of people like Dave Lacey, a former Montgomery County police officer. Lacey suffered from substance abuse disorder for 10 years before entering long-term recovery. The gravel-voiced officer now works with others in law enforcement struggling with opioid addiction.
And they're able to talk to me badge to badge where somebody else would, they would still be guarded.
But Miremont CEO Tom Kane says the day's conversation was dominated by how to pay for services.
You know, we stay pretty full. Other rehabs stay pretty full. So I think the more funding and the more access to treatment, I think, is what people were talking about the most.
Trump has received both cheers and jeers for his drug addiction policy. In its proposed 2018 budget, his administration calls for reducing Medicaid funding over time, something that concerns providers. The entitlement program pays for about a third of people currently in treatment. But last month, Trump received praise for calling the epidemic a national emergency at the urging of advisors on his special opioid commission. But the president hasn't taken steps to make that declaration official. Doing so would open up emergency funds for states that are hardest hit. Price told reporters that the president is still weighing his options.
We're in the process, literally as we speak, of determining what the formality of that, what that is.
But Price says he's confident that the new policy will be announced soon. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
To what extent can successful learning programs in one location be implemented in other locations, say Philadelphia? Well, that topic will be taken up Tuesday at Drexel University's Learning Innovation Conversation Series. Joining me in conversation with a preview is Katrina Stevens, former Deputy Director of the Office of Education Technology at the Department of Education during the Obama administration. Katrina, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
The topic is, in a sense, moving beyond ed tech jargon to help students learn how to learn. So why don't we start with that? What is ed tech?
Education technology, or short ed tech, basically are any tools, platforms, apps that we're using to help students or teachers learn.
You are, let's also note, a former teacher, administrator, now consultant, and a lot of your work was done in Baltimore. Talk about what you inherited there and what was developed.
So I worked in Baltimore County Public Schools, and part of my job there was to really bring out the Common Core. We had over 100,000 students. Some of the work that I was involved in was really around how do we create common language across all of the disciplines and across all of the schools, because the students were quite different in different parts of the district. When I was there, it was a time when we hit the fairly significant budget crisis, and we had to get rid of about 80 mentor positions. So we worked together on creating some education technology to actually try to solve some of those problems and help be able to allow teachers to get the support they needed at a scale within the budget that we had. But that got me to realize that tools should be created with thinking through what the actual problems in schools were. And I think that that's part of the conversation that we need to have, which is around getting educators and that voice to be more part of the conversation about how tools are created and how they're modified and adjusted so that they work better to meet the needs of students and teachers.
Your work in government and as a district administrator and as a teacher, you are no stranger to bureaucracy and hierarchy. And so with that, do you have cause for optimism? Of course, there's no quick fix, but can these changes be implemented in 5 years, 10, decades? What's the timeline?
So I would go with more than 5 years. I think we're at a moment where a lot of factors are coming together. We're now at a point where a significant number, over 80% of our schools have broadband access, for instance. So we now have the connectivity we need to run this kind of technology. There's a number of experiments that have been running. As part of one with when I was at EDGE, created something called the EdTech Rapid Cycle Evaluation Coach. Totally free, and in fact, not even just free, it's openly licensed. Anyone can ask for the code. But it's a tool that allows teachers to be able to run their own pilots and be able to capture information and be able to share that without needing to have, you know, have the really expensive infrastructure around that. I think given the current kind of administration, in terms of government, I think a lot of this work is shifting to the states. So I think that's a place to put a lot of energy, that states can really start doing some of this work. And then, you know, just the nonprofits and other agencies and organizations, I think, are going to play a key role. I don't think we can look as much to the federal government for the support for this kind of work.
One thing for certain, there's plenty of food for thought for a lively conversation come Tuesday. Katrina, thanks so much for joining us with a preview.
Thank you for having me.
Katrina Stevens, former Deputy Director of the Office of Education Technology at the Department of Education in the Obama administration. She'll be speaking Tuesday at Drexel University's Learning Innovation Conversation Series. A Delaware filmmaker and veteran who's been on and off the battlefield is working on a series of projects to preserve the voices of those who served the country, particularly in Vietnam, as WHYY's Nichelle Polston reports.
The story of veterans who were in Vietnam is an important part of history and one of those projects. Delaware filmmaker T.J. Healy wanted to get up close and personal with Vietnam veterans by having them tell their stories on camera. He's looking to interview 450 veterans.
One of the reasons we got this project going, because of the stories these guys. People need to hear their stories.
The goal is to create an oral history of that war. A short excerpt from the video, They Answered the Call, previously recorded by Healy, sums up all those who fought in that war.
From across the country and down the street, enlisted or drafted, they answered the call.
Healy's production office shows a map of where Vietnam soldiers were drafted or deployed. The total number of vets who served across the country is 8,180,445. In Delaware, the number nearly reached 26,000. To date, Healy has recorded the personal accounts of 20 Delaware veterans, including David Rice.
The biggest problem over there was the Agent Orange. I remember standing in the middle of a field with a jet sprayed Agent Orange, and we would buy produce from the Vietnamese. And that meant you were eating the Agent Orange by the time you got it on your table.
Healy started recording 2 years ago. He made those recordings a part of his oral history archive called the Veterans Story Project. He later decided to dedicate a series to Vietnam veterans.
For Vietnam, we're going to have an hour and a half documentary. This is just for the state. We're going to have an hour and a half documentary and also lesson plans by Wilmington University that will go again back into the public schools and the private schools.
Kathleen Gilbert joined the project that's expected to develop into a bigger outreach, capturing the stories of men and women across the country as well.
I had friends who went to Vietnam, not all came back. TJ had friends who went to Vietnam, and we started talking about we ought to do something that really inspires people to find out more about war, about peace, about military, about commitment, about service.
To see things come full circle, Healy and Gilbert developed relationships with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, U.S. Department of Defense, and the United States of America Vietnam Commemoration 50th Anniversary. According to Gilbert, there's one common theme.
Self-sacrifice. I think that's something that maybe everyone could learn from civilians. I mean, you don't have to be in the military to be a person who thinks of others, but their depth of putting others first when they're in a combat or even if they're not in combat.
The message will extend beyond the video. It will also be included on a promotional tour bus designed to serve as a mobile studio. Gilbert says the moving billboard will then be used as a veterans outreach resource center to promote employment, job training, counseling, even educational opportunities. The tour will start in Delaware and then travel across the country for about 5 to 6 years.
It's not always centered around death, because some people think, oh my gosh, I don't want to hear about Vietnam because so many people died. They did. But there are so many people who are alive to tell their stories, the stories of the people on the wall and their own.
According to project leaders, although majority of this particular series will include Vietnam veterans, those who fought in Korea will be honored too. And another excerpt from the video explains why.
Because they answered the call, we can only say thank you. Thank you.
From the Delaware Desk, Nichelle Polston, WHYY News.
For more stories from the era, tune into the premiere of Ken Burns' documentary series, The Vietnam War, this Sunday evening at 8 on WHYY-TV. During Wednesday night's White House dinner, President Donald Trump had what the administration described as a constructive conversation with Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer regarding immigration reform. Let's set the table with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hi, hello, Dave.
Frank, regardless of what comes from that dinner, are Americans pleased that Republicans are speaking with Democrats?
I think they are, at least in principle. We have not asked specifically about Trump's meeting with these Democratic leaders, but we have been asking for a number of years, 8 years exactly now, Americans, whether or not they think that their elected representatives should stick to principles or should give up on principles to compromise. And we have this year, we just finished asking it, we have more Americans now saying that their leaders should compromise than we have measured at any time over the last 8 years. 54% of Americans tilt towards that compromise side of the balance scale. Only 18% say that their elected representatives should stick to their principles and not compromise, and about 3 out of 10 are kind of in the middle.
That regard for Congress as a body is typically, shall we say, abysmal. Can we infer that the public is less principled than the lawmakers they send to Washington?
Well, it's an interesting question, a complicated question, because we know that a lot of lawmakers are now in districts which tilt very heavily one way or the other, and they are actually elected then in the primary process, which is a minority of voters in their district, and they tend to be the more extreme at either end. But we can say if you put all of Americans together, as just mentioned, yes, Americans would say to their elected representatives, get in there and compromise in order to get things done.
Frank, unemployment's low. The stock market is high. How do Americans feel in terms of satisfaction with the way things are going in the country today?
Not all that great. We are at 25% satisfaction now with the way things are going in this country. Seemingly, it should be higher for the reasons you just mentioned. Economic confidence is up. The economy's looking good. You know, but at a comparable time back in the late 1990s, when we had the dot-com boom going on and the stock market was very high, satisfaction was up as high as 70%. And now we're stuck down to just a quarter of Americans who say they're satisfied with the way things are going. Our analysis is we think that's probably reflective of the way government is working in Washington, not just a reflection of the economy when we ask that right track, wrong track question.
Let's look at right lane, left lane, and specifically satisfaction with the auto industry.
Yeah, that's quite interesting because there was a time not so long ago when just a quarter of Americans, actually 24% to be specific, Dave, said that they had a favorable image of the auto industry, and that was in 2009, right after we had the recession. Remember, the government bailed out the auto industry, essentially. But that image has come up, and it's come up, and it's come up, and now we're at a point where 56% of Americans tell us they have a positive image of the auto industry, and that's the highest we've ever measured. And it reflects not only Democrats, but the fact that Republicans have recovered from their negative image of the bailout, we think. And now the Republicans are actually more positive than Democrats nationally when we put those two words in front of them, auto industry.
Frank, lastly, let's go overseas and back then to American attitudes regarding the latest from North Korea.
We had asked Americans back in 2003, Dave, about North Korea, because there was a lot of concern then about North Korea having nuclear weapons, just as is the case now. And we found some changes in attitudes when we just re-asked these questions. One of the most important ones, I think, is the question, if the U.S. does not accomplish its goals regarding North Korea with economic and diplomatic efforts, would you favor or oppose military action against North Korea? And that's gone up. 58% of Americans say they would favor military action against North Korea, with all that that could entail, if the diplomatic and economic efforts aren't successful. And 14 years ago in 2003, that was 47%. So we've had an increased hawkish position, it looks like to us, on North Korea over the last decade and a half or so.
Though interesting with that phrase, with all it could entail, what it could entail now is nuclear war, and that wasn't the case more than a decade ago.
That's right. There are a lot of ominous signs, of course, about what could happen if military action did break out on either side in North Korea and on that peninsula involving Japan and Guam and mainland U.S. and everything we've been reading about. One thing we can say, though, is we have over 80% who say they're following the situation there closely. So we can't say that Americans are just kind of blithely saying, yeah, military action without really knowing what's going on, because the indications are that the average American is paying attention to these extremely sensitive happenings there in the Korean Peninsula.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. How can the past influence the future? That's the question at the heart of Cotton and Gold, a play debuting this weekend as part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. The play is set in post-apocalyptic America as one man attempts to save his town from growing gentrification. WHYY's Danielle Fox reports.
In a Center City rehearsal space, six student actors slowly begin to melt out of their chairs and onto the floor. Then they come together, imitating different parts of a machine. In the background, Elise Hogan narrates the scene.
And the warp whistle rings out. We see...
Hogan is the writer and director of the Afrofuturist play Cotton and Gold. As a genre, Afrofuturism explores the experiences of Black people through science fiction. The play takes place in a post-apocalyptic landscape. Each town is represented by a machine. In this rehearsal scene, the actors are embodying the machine of the town Rankin.
The Rankin machine. The stage is oil and rust.
In Rankin, the community members are fighting hard to get by as their town becomes increasingly gentrified by the sinister and mysterious entity known as Metropolis, which Hogan says is a stand-in for corporate America. The play follows a young man named Lauren Sr. as he leaves Rankin to find solutions.
He's searching for answers as to why his town is being gentrified, why the people in his town are hurting one another and disagreeing with one another.
Gentrification can have many definitions, but often refers to when low-income people are pushed out of their neighborhoods by new development geared toward people with higher incomes. In Cotton and Gold, Lauren travels to a thriving city called Tulsa to figure out how to save his town. The city is modeled after the actual Tulsa, Oklahoma of the early 1900s, when it was one of the wealthiest Black communities in the nation and known as Black Wall Street.
And it was so economically independent that I think they said it took about a month for a dollar to even leave Tulsa. So Tulsa became the, like, utopia of this whole play.
Hogan says an important theme in Cotton and Gold is looking back at history. It's why she wrote the play in an Afrofuturistic style, to reimagine Black Wall Street and reflect on how that history can inspire Black businesses and communities now.
There are wonderful Black organizations that exist today and that are continuing to be built, but at the same time, some of these places can still be taken away through gentrification. So it's like, how do we hold on to what we have?
Over the years, she's watched her hometown change, like when an apartment complex in her neighborhood was bulldozed. Within the past year, new coffee shops and a luxury apartment building have opened in the area. And Hogan says those changes are upsetting.
How do you tell somebody, I know you've been living here for 20 years, but you gotta go? I don't want that feeling that, like, Black people could, like, be erased, but, like, that's what it feels like.
Hogan says she's tired of just talking about what's wrong. And she hopes Cotton and Gold will inspire the audience to support Black-owned businesses and artists well into the future. For WHYY, Danielle Fox.
One of the headlining plays in the Fringe Festival this weekend is A Billion Nights on Earth. It's a fantasy about a father and son who discover a portal to a magic world in their refrigerator. Created by longtime Fringe Festival favorite Thaddeus Phillips, and starring the real father and son from Allentown, Michael and Winslow Fegley. Michael's a veteran actor, and at just 8 years old, his son Winslow already has a few acting roles under his belt. They came into the WHY studio to talk about performing on stage together.
So in A Billion Nights on Earth, we've kind of built this whole thing around this relationship between a real father and a real son. Do you think we really captured it? Do you think it's... just like our relationship at home?
In some cases, it's different, definitely, because you go through like a fridge into a magic world and things.
So that's not necessarily the real thing that happens in our life.
But some of the real things is my character is kind of based off of me. My name is Winslow in the play, so.
Well, there you go. And my name is Dad.
Which is pretty much what I call you all the time.
Right. Do you remember when Thaddeus first told us about this show?
Yeah, that was in March.
And he was traveling back from New York to Bogota, and he stopped and stayed with us in Allentown for a couple of days.
I guess that was kind of our audition.
It was, and you started spinning ideas with him right away. And what was your favorite part about this whole process? Because this is very different from other shows you've done, right?
Yeah. Other shows I've done, you would have a script and you would kind of just work off of that. But this is different because I kind of get to see how my ideas can come to life, kind of. If I have an idea, I can just tell Thaddeus, and he'll try and work it out into the show.
But what's it like when you're working on a show with your dad, and you have to answer to two bosses, right?
Yeah, and sometimes that's a problem, but sometimes it kind of makes it easier. With my dad, I can always just wake up in the morning and we can work on our script, or at dinner, or at lunch, whenever, really. But the part that makes it worse is I just want you to be proud of me.
Oh, and you know I'm super proud of you. You're absolutely fearless. And that's what makes you a good actor.
Michael and Winslow Fegley, stars of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival play A Billion Nights on Earth. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. At the controls this week, Charlie Kyer and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene Son, and Katie Culinary is our Assistant News Director. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.